Gaza flotilla that was boarded by the Israeli Navy, women soldiers, and you were taken to Ashdod and then to a prison and then released. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Now, tell us, though, about the situation in Gaza, why you would risk doing this. One of the ships didn't even make it.
Well, that's correct. One of the ships had engine problems leaving Barcelona, and we had women from all over the world that had come in, and they were great people who continue to speak about the tragedy of Gaza. As we approached the coastline of Gaza, it was unbelievable. To the left, you could see all of the lights of Israel. To the right, a very distinct line was darkness all the way to the south, and that's Gaza. And that exemplifies what's going on there, that the lack of electricity, usually less than 4 hours a day, the lack of medical supplies. Dr. Fazia Hassan, who was our medical doctor from Malaysia, she said her organization, My Care Malaysia, is trying to reduce the time for operations which in Gaza, which now go on to 2025. There are people lined up, and they're trying to reduce the time that people who need life-saving operations have it. The issue of food, of water, of sewage, all of these things make for the United Nations now saying by the year 2020, Gaza will be uninhabitable.
And yet the Obama administration, while continuing to increase its criticism of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, does nothing about the situation.
No, and in fact, they give them $38 billion in military and other type of aid, which will be used to hammer the Palestinians both in Gaza and in the West Bank.
I mean, this $38 billion, the largest military funding package the U.S. has given any nation.
Any nation. And it will be used is in the training fields of the Israeli military, which are in Gaza. Gaza is the place where military experiments are done using U.S. military weaponry and done by the IDF.
You're a former U.S. military?
Yes. I'm a colonel, 29 years in the U.S. military. And I say the U.S. military and our government are complicit in the crimes against the people of Gaza and the West Bank by the use of our military hardware and by the training that the Israelis give us and we give them.
What happened to the aid on the boat?
Well, actually, the aid was really minor. I mean, it was us coming as representatives of the international community. We only had a little 50-foot boat. We really weren't carrying substantial amounts of anything other than goodwill from the international community.
Were you deported?
Oh, yeah. Now I have a 20-year deportation, 10 years from 2000.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Colonel Anne Wright, retired Army Colonel Anne Wright, former U.S. diplomat, was one of the 13 women on the Zaytuna Olivia, the women's boat to Gaza, attempting to break Israel's 9-year naval blockade on Gaza. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our website is democracynow.org. Thank you.
Camu at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Sex and Broadcasting, will play Thursday, October 13th at 7 p.m. Sex and Broadcasting is a documentary about the revolutionary independent radio station WFMU and its station manager, Ken Friedman. The film explores the question of how to do interesting, cool, culturally significant radio and internet broadcasting while being a sustainable institution.
I just want there to be a WFMU. I want WFMU to exist as a place where people can go who don't fit in, where people can go to find things that have been hidden.
Again, that's Sex and Broadcasting, Thursday, October 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Finance Committee meets the third Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice of board meetings in writing, please email Monica at kbu.org.
Good morning. We're back once again here on KBU. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. Be with you for the next 55 minutes until 9 o'clock when Political Perspectives comes your way. And that was Blackfire, One Nation Under, which may or may not become a theme song. This is a new edition of our program. Jacqueline Keeler, who you've heard a number of times as a guest on this program, is now going to be co-hosting once a month in this second Thursday time slot. And she's on the line with us. She was going to be in the studio, but she was planning a trip to Standing Rock for a while, and it turned out that she had to leave yesterday. And so she's somewhere, I believe, in Montana. Good morning, Jacqueline.
Yes, hi.
So where are you at?
I'm still in Washington State. We're going to drive all day today. So
long drive. So let me just read this little bit of this introduction leading up to this program, which is called Pollen Nation Report, and you can explain the origins of that name. So today is October 12th, which is the traditional Columbus Day, marking the day in 1492 that the first Columbus expedition made landfall in the Western Hemisphere on an island, as yet still uncertain which is island exactly, not that it matters, in the Caribbean. The day is still recognized as a national holiday in the United States and throughout many other countries in the Americas, although since 1970 it is observed as a U.S. federal holiday on the second Monday in October. Just 2 days ago, but especially since the rise of Red Power and the American Indian Movement in the 1960s, along with the People's History Movement to correct distortions, prejudices, and omissions in the dominant historical narrative, there's been a steadily growing resistance to celebrating the onset of brutal colonization and genocide in the, quote, Americas. In recent years, a number of U.S. cities, including Portland and Seattle, have renamed the day Indigenous Peoples Day. Portland celebrated its second Indigenous Peoples Day this past Monday with a big event up at the zoo I didn't go to. I did go to another event at the Native American Student and Community Center at Portland State, all around Standing Rock. So anyway, this week's show, following October 12th, seems like a auspicious time to inaugurate this new edition of Wednesday Talk Radio with Jacqueline Keeler. And Jacqueline, I forgot to put your introduction in here, too, so maybe you can just talk a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I am Navajo and Yankton Dakota Sioux, and I live in Portland, Oregon area, and I am a writer, and I'm actually traveling partly to North Dakota to write about it, and yeah, the name Pollen Nation report comes from, I'm working with some other Native journalists, and we're starting our own sort of what we call a Native New Yorker magazine. And we've called it Pollen Nation. And in fact, actually, Cleve Annoli, who is with Black Fire, the song that you played, he is helping us design the magazine. And so it's a collective effort of Native people. And we basically wanted to sort of have a resource where we could develop the sort of the intellectual discourse around Native issues nationally, and work with work on the ground with local local Native journalism all over in our communities, and make sure that it's heard, get it into mainstream publications. And so we Pollen Nation. Pollen is something that we pray with. Navajo people pray with pollen. Corn is central to our spirituality. In Navajo, we call it Nadan. And so we pray with the corn pollen. And in the morning, we also pray with cornmeal. And so they say when we first emerged into this world, the holy people came, and they rolled back the waters, and they brought us corn and gave us sort of all the ceremonies and the songs we needed to live in harmony with the earth. And it's sort of the exact opposite of the story, the creation story out of the Bible, where people are rejected by God and sent out into this cruel world, you know, to live a life of suffering. In the Navajo creation story, we are emerge here and we are embraced by everything that is sacred and shown how to live in harmony. And so, so Pollen Nation, is our way of addressing that. We want, you know, we want a different way of thinking about the world, about our relationship with it. It's a direct opposition to, you know, the extractive, exploitive, sort of, Armageddon sort of a laced narrative and thought process that goes into so much of the Judeo-Christian mindset that basically runs this world. And, you know, where all the resources are given to them by God to do what they want with, and that the end times will come and we don't have to worry about the long-term issues. That's not how our creation story tells us to live in this world. And, you know, and our symbol is the bee, which is, of course, now endangered. And so we really are positioning our thing, not only intellectually, well, it is an intellectual exercise to position ourselves in opposition, but also thoroughly grounded in our own cultural mindset and traditions.
And, of course, if you say all those two words together quickly, I assume that was probably, since you mentioned the bee, is part of the, there's a play on words there. Pollination, obviously, is kind of like the idea of, I assume this is in your thinking, dissemination, the idea of spreading ideas, I assume.
Yes, exactly. When you say it together like that. And yeah, we have our inspiration was a bee, a close-up of a bee covered in pollen. And so it's sort of, that's sort of our symbol for ourselves.
And of course, the bees being in extreme peril, obviously.
Yes. By the actions of the present model. I'm also Dakota, and so going to Standing Rock is a sense for me going home. That area, Cannonball, was part of our original treaty lands for the Yankton people. The Yankton and the Yanktonai, linguists call the Nakota, we were the people of the Missouri River. And so, you know, of course, the Lakota, the Tetuan, were to the west of the Missouri River. That's why they speak a different dialect. And so those sites that were disturbed by the energy transfer partners, security crew and construction crew, were actually Yankton sites. And so a lot of people don't realize that Standing Rock has Ihanktuan, Tetuan, and Yanktonai bands in it. They were all put on one reservation.
So we're going to get into all these things. You wanted to talk, focus on the whole issue of sovereignty, which is something that, you know, you always touch upon when you talk, and we've discussed here, but we'll have a time to get a little deeper into it today. But bringing up what you just said just now, so, you know, people have heard that, and it's shocking, but unfortunately not surprising. It's almost like it's like the standard operating procedure of the colonizer is to do, you know, do preemptive strikes like that on that site that was not that area where they constructed several weeks ago on the Saturday after the information about that site was given to the court and obviously then shared with the defendants who then used that to go and do that. So those sites you said are of your people, the Yankton. What sort of what are the laws in terms of, you know, we know that there's the NAGPRA, the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, which finally, after decades and centuries of looting and grave robbing, did institute some protections, specifically, I believe, on federal land. What sort of protections are there for sites like that on so-called private land?
Right now my tribe, the Yankton Sioux tribe, has filed a lawsuit, and so they are it's still in process, and so they because that territory is under our treaty territory, the 1851 treaty, the lawsuit is filed under, our sovereign rights, and we have other acts of Congress that cover that. And we're traveling right now, so I'm sort of, but my tribe has the right to sue, and a lot of people look at the reservations, the reservation land, and think that's where the only area where people have rights or culture rights is on reservation land. But in fact, basically what we are left with are these sort of island states left of the Great Sioux Nation. And what the story of the DAPL protest is really about is it's about the reconstitution of the Great Sioux Nation, which we call the Ocheti-Shakowin, which is the seven council fires. And Yankton is one of the council fires. Yanktonai is another. Of course, the Dakota have theirs, the Mittewakanton, the Santee, and then the Tetuan are one of the council fires, and they have a number of sub-bands, which are very famous, like the Humpa and the Ogallala. And so part of Chairman Archambault's vision is bringing back the seven council fires back together again. And those, our territories encompass areas going all the way from the Great Lakes to into Montana and up into Alberta and down into Nebraska. And so we have like remnant states left. And so all the land in between, of course, we have cultural historical rights to, and these burial sites and these archaeological sites that were dug up are symbolic of that. And other tribes do as well. Like there's a Mandan site across the river from Cannonball. And the pipeline companies are like, oh, well, it's not on your reservation. We're like, one mile north. And it's that is sort of a lie, because all that land that you see in between the different Sioux reservations is often covered under treaty. It's what they call unceded treaty land. So we never really legally gave it up. It's just being occupied. Basically, a lot of the U.S. is just occupied by force. This entire state of Nevada, the Shoshone never actually ceded that land. And so under international law, a lot of the U.S. holdings of lands is strictly by force. It's not legitimate. It's not legal. And they do it with impunity.
Well, as I said, there's many facets to the issues that we're going to bring up in this program and presumably in the months to come, and maybe we can get into some sort of basic definitions. And again, this is a new version of this show called Pollen Nation Report with my co-host Jacqueline Keeler, who is with us by phone on the road. She left a bit earlier than anticipated on her way to Standing Rock in North Dakota. And I know we wanted to talk about some things, events you've been involved with recently, but maybe we could, I just wanted to mention, this is going to remain a call-in show, and we're going to be, focusing specifically on issues involving Native Americans, their history, politics, governance, culture, relations with a dominant society, stereotyping and racism, and all other aspects. But, of course, these things are not just of interest to Native Americans. They are or should be of interest and relevance to all of us because all of us do reside, as Jacqueline was just saying, in colonized indigenous territory, which, may seem kind of abstract to people. But then, when things like this pipeline issue comes up, especially those of us who see how dire the situation is regarding climate change and just the toxicity of the environment from, mechanized culture, that we see that if we're trying to stop things like this, there's a growing understanding among activists and the general public who's tuned in, especially cable listeners, that indigenous peoples really are kind of leading the way on so many of these issues, and that strengthening indigenous sovereignty, giving support to Native people in their issues and struggles is really possibly the thing that can most effectively combat this seemingly suicidal social machine that we're involved in. So let's get to this issue of sovereignty. You just said that there's various acts of Congress under which you can sue, but even that is a sort of already a diminishment of sovereignty. It's what's known as the plenary power of Congress. Maybe talk a little bit about that. I know we've talked about that some, but I think it bears really driving that point home to people.
Yeah, I think that what we are at is a real sort of referendum on the relationship that the U.S. has dictated to tribes. It's the federal recognition process, the treaty process, which the U.S. government suspended in, I think, 1871. The treaty process, I mean, you always hear Native people talking about honor the treaties, the treaty law and all that stuff. It's not this special sort of subset of law that applies only between Indians and the United States. Treaties are actually international documents. And the U.S. government, the Senate, does not ratify treaties. And they do not ratify treaties with anyone but other sovereign nations. And so so the actual act of treating with the Great Sioux Nation and all these entities actually recognizes their sovereign status under international law. And under international law, you cannot treaty away your existence. So simply signing a treaty does not extinguish your sovereignty. So technically, we still exist as sovereign nations, and we are simply suppressed through the use of military force by the United States, the most powerful country in the world. And so, what we are seeing, and hopefully what we'll see here, is a movement towards the real full recognition of sovereignty and a more collective representation of it, like the reconstituting of the Great Sioux Nation from these sort of remnant states of reservations comprising many different bands. And going back to a full expression of sovereignty.
Well, may I be so bold as to suggest that there's another alternative, which is that if indeed Native indigenous people in the United States are living a suppressed temporarily perhaps diminished sovereignty. And the reality is that it's, they're living under an occupied force. The alternative to what you're saying is the reassertion of full sovereignty would be the reassertion of overt military force. which seems to be what's happening.
Well, I think that the reassertion of military force is happening solely on the side of the U.S. government, and then, of course, of North Korea.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what I mean.
Yeah. When you see the heavy military presence that North Dakota has brought out, you know, they went and borrowed $6 million from their own state-owned bank just to bankroll this military armed response to peaceful, prayerful protest by the Standing Rock Sioux tribe is really it illustrates quite starkly the nature of states. I think that's a discussion that we should have, or what are states? You know, but colonizing aggregations of power, you know, to basically take resources from the land of other people. And so you see the state acting in concert with an oil company from Texas and demanding the right to dig up our graves and to threaten our water sources. Just to pursue an economic policy that actually doesn't really stand up to much scrutiny, even by experts. I think this does call in. I think what I would like to see come out of this is for Americans to really question the nature of their country. I mean, we see a lot of overt patriotism nowadays, but we don't really question the origins of what we are. And I mean, states are fairly recent creations. They are not really old, and their history. I mean, the state of North Dakota was originally the first corporate power was probably the railroads that built railroads through North Dakota. And my great aunt, she was Ella Deloria. She was an ethnologist. She spoke all three dialects of our language, and she about 100 years ago, she went and interviewed elders all over that area. She lived at Standing Rock, Wakpala, and they have stories about saving the lives of the railroad used to just dump white families off along their tracks to act as buffers from the Indians. They'd drop them off in the middle of winter with nothing but a box to live in.
First and, human shields.
Yes, we use them as human shields, and so the use of white pioneers, and the term pioneer comes from the French military term for peons, lower class people who they used to put ahead of the regular French army because they were expendable. And so the whole structure of it is very feudalistic. I think that very top down. I think North Dakota, I understand, was the first state, the white people that organized and elected the first socialist governor. I mean, they were extremely active after being mistreated so much by corporations in the 19th century.
But the story you're in the middle of that I interrupted, that you had told me that those families that were dropped off, then your ancestors saved them, right?
Yes, we saved them because we saw them there and we took them in. And so, there is a long history of collaboration. I think, and I'm hoping we'll see more of that. I know that finding the Keystone XL pipeline, my Aunt Faith's Spotted Eagle worked very hard on that. And one of the things she put together was the Cowboy and Indian Alliance. And so bringing together white non-native farmers and ranchers to oppose the pipeline. And it's very difficult for them to do that because, of course, they're operating on fairly slim margins already. And to take on a pipeline, a company like Energy Transfer or TransCanada, who has limitless funds, and the laws are stacked against them. I mean, these pipelines are given governmental powers. They're viewed as in the national interest. Even when they're owned by foreign companies, and they are allowed to declare eminent domain and take people's land. And you saw that family that owned the organic beef ranch there where those grave sites were disturbed in North Dakota. They just went and sold out. They just gave up because it's just too much. It's hard to find white farmers and ranchers who are willing to put themselves through that and take it on. But we have found them, and they've been really great allies.
So you're listening to Pollen Nation Report with my new co-host, monthly co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who's on the road heading to Standing Rock. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm Paul Roland. And there is a number to call in, 503-231-8187. This is a wide-ranging discussion. But I know the other day, you know, the whole issue of sovereignty gets really complicated with the process of not just of colonization, but then the fracturing of native of tribal groups into factions, the sort of the divide and conquer strategies, the whole sort of desperate economic straits that some native nations find themselves in and then need to turn to various stratagems to confront that, and all kinds of other things. And you were at a rally in Sacramento just a few days ago talking about the issue of tribal disenrollment. I know that's something that doesn't get a lot of attention. Here in Oregon, it got some attention recently because the Grand Ronde people disenrolled some of their memberships. And then that was, I believe, overturned in court. Talk about this issue of disenrollment and what it means within the context of sovereignty.
Yeah. So I was in Sacramento last week, and I got to come out and speak at a couple of protests. They had one at the state capitol building, and which is, of course, this total homage to ancient Greek and Roman culture, you know, the empire. and then they had a protest at the BIA building, regional office there in Sacramento, and the role the BIA plays in all of this. And disenrollment has emerged as a real threat to the competency of our sovereignty. Imagine, if you will, that someone didn't like you, or they, you know, they could strip you of your U.S. citizenship. And that is not possible because, of course, under the 14th Amendment, everyone is guaranteed their citizenship. But you could get rid of people you didn't like that way. Let's say, you know, Trump didn't like someone, and he could just strip them of their U.S. citizenship, and they'd be a stateless person. And so this is a disruptive sort of thing that's going on, and it's based in corruption, sadly enough. And our people are not perfect. I think that when we talk about sovereignty, we have to talk about checks and balances. We have to devise systems that will work for us today to make sure that we have equal representation and justice, social justice, and the right to speak out if we don't, you know, politically without retribution. And So these families had been disenrolled. Of course, here we have, you know, the whole issue with Grand Ronde, and then of course the Nooksack in Washington State, and so these are ongoing problems. And that's part of the issue that they're facing, and they're seeking. What they wanted me to speak about was the idea of creating a sort of our own federal government so that they have some place to appeal to that is not the U.S. federal government. Right now, when they try to appeal for justice, they have to go to, ironically, for their sovereignty, they have to go to the U.S. federal courts and try to get them to intervene. One of the tribes I spoke to, the Hopland Pomo, they have a Bill of Rights and everything, but it's just not being honored. And so,
but let's explain what this is all about. So enrollment, you have to be enrolled to be disenrolled. Enrollment is based upon the fact that Native nations, tribes are recognized through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and there are certain mechanisms, there are certain criteria for being enrolled in those tribes, and based upon, in many cases, blood quantum, I think. But maybe you could explain a little bit about that and then explain like how they go about disenrolling people.
Yeah. So the idea of blood quantum was introduced by the U.S. government. They were seeking, part of it was driven by a desire to make Indians disappear. So imagine that your U.S. citizenship was, that you had to, your family had to maintain a certain percentage of Revolutionary War blood, you know, ancestors who had fought in the Revolutionary War. And you can see how problematic that would quickly become, where you would have people who could no longer, you'd have to choose your mates based on how much, you know, ancestry they had, who had served in that war. And after a while, it become, as the country grows, it becomes more and more unworkable and pretty ridiculous, you know, and it becomes a human rights violation because you have and have nots. You have people who can qualify for citizenship. And I think you see that in Europe, you know, some European countries, you know, you have immigrant communities who can basically never become citizens because of the issue of descendancy in their naturalization process. And so, and then it creates difficulties for those communities if they can never achieve citizenship despite living there. The U.S. has an unusual policy of naturalization, which many nations around the world do not have. And so, this blood quantum thing has been, you know, really difficult for tribes, and we definitely want to get rid of it. And it was a way to make tribes disappear. So there'd be fewer and fewer people of a certain blood quantum. And then finally they would just be gone. They wouldn't be a threat anymore. But with how it's being used, and in some tribes you have to have be on an enrollment. You have to be on the rolls of the tribe. You have to have an ancestor on the rolls of the tribe. I know that the Hoplin Pomo, they had reformulated their membership rules in 1961. So all you had to be was have a relative on the rolls in 1961. And this family were able to prove through papers and everything, you know, documentation, that they were members from till going back to 1850. And what they were called out on by a family that was acting against them was that their ancestor, she was taken in by the tribe, she was Pomo as well, but a different band. So she was taken in by their band. When the 49ers came out, they were brutal. They committed genocide.
That's the gold miners in 1849. Yeah.
Another wonderful mascot. So they had decimated her band, and she was a young girl just, you know, on her own. And so this band took her in, and they saw that's the reason why they're disenrolling the family. And even though that doesn't meet the requirement, I mean, obviously that's not actually their rules for membership. And the family that was trying to they told me that the family that was trying to disenroll them had only joined their tribe in 1921. So it's being applied extremely selectively and in a way to sort of just kick out a family that they don't like and as political retribution.
So it'd be as if, you know, if Trump became president and he was able to, you know, disenroll American citizens, which I guess he's in a way that's what he's advocating. It's hard for non-native people to imagine the intricacies, complexities of these politics. I think that's something that hopefully will be a valuable addition to the KBOO airwaves, this monthly program with you, to really tease out some of these things. And you know, again, it's not, I hope people aren't getting the impression that, you know, this is just sort of a intra-Native American program. It's these things have, well, first of all, we should understand the history, and we should, because of all that's happened, those of us who come from colonizer stock like myself should really go out of our way to understand these things so we can be supportive in these kind of struggles. But as I said, it's the continuing claims of sovereignty and claims for being able to manage in a better way than we are is a really, I've thought for 20 or 30 years, is one of the only only ways that I can see to actually get somewhere more seriously, along with the community rights movement, along with really creative things like our Children's Trust lawsuit, really challenging some of the getting back to sort of reclaiming some of the roots within the American Constitution that do have some sanity in them, and then questioning things like some of the fundamentals of the Constitution, like the Commerce Clause. I think we really have to get, much more in depth in terms of our historical understanding of the way things operate. So anyway, I'm just going on here. Let me just say that coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, we speak with supporters of the campaign finance measure that Multnomah County voters will consider this November, which I think is really, really fascinating, that whole issue of trying to push the whole issue of campaign finance reform through a measure on the Multnomah County ballot. And I know Ralph Nader's coming in a week and a half. We'll probably be talking about that. At 9:30, we'll hear an interview with professor and White Rage author Carol Anderson about structural racism in the United States, especially in the context of this presidential campaign. And once again, thank all of you KBOO members for your generous support. And if you're not a current member, you can always become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And of course, thank all of you who are listening, whether or not you are a member. Of course, we always prefer that you are. But thank you for tuning in. And we have a caller, I hope he's still there, who's been waiting very patiently for 5 or 10 minutes. Harvey, you're still with us.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, first of all, I want to thank the indigenous tribal people of America for fighting the good fight. It's so important for life on the planet. And people don't realize, that the burning of fossil fuels causes climate destabilization, which leads to longer droughts and floods, out of control wildfires, stronger and more frequent hurricanes and tornadoes that are putting us all in jeopardy. And I believe that the banks are the main culprit in this battle for our small planet. They make trillions of dollars financing the mining, the drilling, the transportation, and the sale of fossil fuels. And the last thing they want us to see us do is move to clean, renewable energy like solar panels, putting solar panels on a rooftop and plugging directly into the sun, which cuts out their profit cycle. And Food and Water Watch revealed that dozens of financial institutions are bankrolling the Dakota Access Pipeline, including the Bank of America, HSBC, UBS, Goldman Sachs, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, Citibank. And if you Google the words, how to contact the 17 banks funding the Dakota Access Pipeline, you'll find out even more banks. But my suggestion is that each and every one of us who has money in these banks, call the banks and tell them that unless they stop funding the Dakota Access Pipeline, you're going to pull your account and put it in a credit union. And that way, each and every one of us has the power because, especially after the Wells Fargo thing when they were creating all these phony accounts, we see these banks will do anything to take money from us. And they are they're the ones who are giving the orders to the governor and all the people. They're the ones because it's all about the money. So since it's all about the money, I say that we can all of us take part in this action by calling on the banks and telling them that unless they change their ways, unless they pull out of this, we are going to pull our account out of their bank.
Okay.
And that's what that's what'll scare them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Harvey. Okay. Jacqueline.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, I agree. Divestment from these banks is really valuable to let them know. I think it's about money, and so that definitely they'll hear that. I hope they'll hear that. I mean, there's a lot of money on the line, and I think it recently came out that even Trump was invested in this pipeline as well.
It's true.
And
In the spirit of that, I don't know how many people caught that Democracy Now! Program that just aired about these five people who shut down these
yes.
five pipelines just by climbing over a fence and shutting off a valve and then waiting there. And I guess they're all in jail now waiting, but that's all in solidarity with what's going on with Standing Rock. And the other thing I want to say is, so anyway, there's an article by one of them, Emily Johnston, The Time for Direct Action on Climate Change is Now. And I've had the Reverend Billy from the Reverend Billy and the Stop Shopping Choir, and they do this amazing thing where they've done some amazing direct actions at banks, specifically over these issues of fossil fuel investment, and using the power of song and sort of transformative energy, which it's just hearing him talk about it, it's really amazing. I'd like to see more of that stuff kind of happen. So if people are interested in getting something like that together, wherever you're listening, here in Portland or elsewhere within our listening range, I would really encourage that. I haven't really seen that sort of take off elsewhere than what they're doing in New York. That's one thing would be really great to see. And the issue of banks, I mean, it goes, if you think about banks and the slave trade, I mean, I started learning about that when I got involved with the Occupy movement in D.C. and the Criminal Injustice Committee that came out of that. And the, bank, really the modern banking industry really rose on the backs of slavery. I mean, the banks have been around for hundreds of years. They really kind of came out of northern Italy in the late Middle Ages. But they didn't become these massive global institutions really until colonization. So it's all tied together. It's all tied together with the colonization of the Americas. The entire development of the capitalist system is tied together with the colonization and slavery, those twin pillars of the United States. Anyway.
Yeah, I think that you can't help but look at the wealth and power of the U.S. and wonder, how did it come about? And of course, it came through the, it's not just that we're an exceptional country and people, that we have God on our side, but it's also that it's just about the taking of resources and then the total focus on exploitation of those resources. I think, for me, when you compare the difference between how, I really recommend people read my great Aunt Ella Deloria's books about where she really talks about what Dakota and Lakota society was like. And I think that a lot of people focus on the spirituality, but really it was the social engineering that our people had that created the kind of people we were, the result that we got. And of course, it's our social structures that were under attack by the colonists, and but she describes in detail how these societies worked. She called them a way of life that worked, and the camp circle society. And so I think I've been having this ongoing discussion with my uncle Sam DeGloria about how scalable these our ways were, and it's something that we really want to take a look at. But the central organizing principle of colonization is profit, and the people, their lives, they are focused on having jobs. In England, a job used to refer to a criminal act, where you were brought in to be part of a crime, sort of an act of crime. And early factory workers called them jobs because they were sneering at the work. This is sort of a form of a criminal enterprise. But in our tradition, our culture, it's about kinship, about how we are related to each other, how we work together, and how we honor each other. And I know that it sounds sort of trite or pat, but when you understand the nuts and bolts of how that society worked, it's amazing. I mean, Native societies and cultural practices have had a huge impact on the world. What we call modernism, is actually indigenous cultural ideas. And, the idea of democracy, to a certain extent, it floated out of ancient Greece, but also it came because the founding fathers saw all around them active living democracies. And that's why it took them coming here to the Americas to break the yoke of feudalism in Europe after thousands of years. And so the Iroquois Confederacy is the inspiration of the U.S. Former democracy, and then we have the women at Seneca Falls, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucy. I can't remember, but they were inspired by the Seneca women. There was a Seneca village next door to Seneca Falls, and they got to observe firsthand them reorganizing their government. And so, if you read the speeches from Seneca Falls, the white women are saying, look at the difference between us, what they have in their communities and what we have. We're white women were legally dead. Iroquois women owned property. It's a matrilineal system. Many of our governments were matrilineal. The colonists called them petticoat governments. And so there was just a very different organizing principle. And I think that even though our societies have been disemboweled by colonialism, there's still a lot to learn about because that's human knowledge, human social engineering. That's very important. That's just as important as it's even more important than a profit motive. That is a valuable resource, and indigenous cultures have ways of doing things that other people don't.
And of course, it seems to many people, I'm sure, given how trapped we all really are in this maze of a system or sort of a social machine based upon the sort of the ruthless exploitation of everything and commodification and all that, it does seem like kind of this, I wouldn't say trite, it seems all unattainable or, something that only existed in the past. Yet, I mean, I think that's why the excitement is just so palpable when you talk to somebody who's been there at the, at the camp there, at Standing Rock, there's actually four camps, I believe, which maybe we can talk a little bit about, but the shine in people's eyes, the way their voice changes when they talk about it, because they're really, it doesn't really feels like they are recreating something like that kind of sociality, the indigenous sociality.
Yeah, I'd almost like to. One of the things I'd like to say about what you see the impact that our social structures have had on the world. I mean, they've made people's lives better, billions, literally billions of people's lives better, through the introduction of democracy and women's rights worldwide. And one of the things I would love to see, and I was talking to Beth LaPense about this, and she's an indigenous woman who does game making. She designs video games. And was to create a video game that where you could act out traditional society and learn how this system works, sort of get it in your brain about a different way of organizing yourself. And because I think that when you have a different way of organizing yourself, you come to different conclusions about what to do, about how to act. The system we have now puts in place people who are not in my husband's tribe and the Iroquois tribe. Iroquois Nation, they have a saying of the good mind, the Royaner, where you have this mind and this is the mind that these traditional social systems were very good at developing and putting people in charge and growing leadership that was for the people. The system we have now, where you have people who are at the top or people who can be ruthless, people who can, work on Wall Street, people like Donald Trump. And you have a sick system, and then you have policies like this of climate change denial, the continuous, stubborn-headed pursuit of policies based on this profit motive that are actually destroying our planet, are destroying our ability to live on our planet, that's a huge contrast. So, yeah, I think the social aspect of what's going on there should not be diminished. I think that it should be, talking to my relatives who were there at the camp, there's this idea this is going to be carried forward, that this is the beginning. And even if, they're just going to, yeah, so it's, it's very exciting.
Well, let's. I haven't given out the number in a while. We only have a little over 5 minutes left, and Tim is on the line. The number is 503-231-8187. Might be able to sneak one or two more people. And go ahead, you're on the line, Tim. Hello? Are you there?
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey, thank you so much for doing this. I had Jackie in my class down there at KBOO the other day. She reminded me that Indigenous Peoples Day was on Monday. And so I was so excited for it. But then I went to the Portland website. Nothing. Radio silence. Nothing listed on the website. I know there's some events. KBOO brings the knowledge to the people. But that's just a small percentage of the Portland population. So I just think the city really dropped the ball. The county dropped the ball. I ended up calling the mayor's office and the commissioner saying they're giving lip service to this Indigenous Peoples Day and not really implementing acknowledgement of it.
Uh-huh. I wasn't aware of that. Thank you for taking independent initiative. That it counts a lot. It's you never know what just one phone call or, you know, can have. And if you multiply that by many, it really that's the way to go. Thanks.
It had totally fallen off my radar, and then Jackie reminded me, and then I got all excited for it, but then there was, the city really didn't acknowledge it. And I appreciate KBOO doing this, and I appreciate you doing this, Paul, and making this a regular thing.
All right. And I think we have one more caller. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I haven't heard, I've heard a lot about the oil pipeline blockage, and I'm so happy they're doing that. And, you know, I work out here and I can't join them, but you know what? They have a website, Standing Rock Sioux, for donations. I hope people who are listening can go to that website, look for easy, and donate some money. They're going to need some money to keep this protest going through a very cold winter, and they're going to be out there doing that, and we need to support them. That's all I need to say, though, today.
All right. Well, maybe we could finish talking about that, Jacqueline. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Both of those points are really excellent. I didn't realize that the Portland City of Portland had not really done much. I know that they had an event last week where they sort of announced it officially again. I was at the City Hall last year when they initially announced it, and I covered that for Indian Country Today. And also the fundraiser, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has an official crowdfunding site called at CrowdRiser, and that's the only official site for raising funds for the tribe. So I would highly recommend going there. It's at CrowdRiser, and you should be able to find it on their Facebook page, on the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe's Facebook page. I've shared it in the past. If you look on Twitter and look at my handle at JF Keeler, you'll see I've shared the official Standing Rock Sioux Tribe fundraiser. They definitely need support and help. The winter is really getting cold already. You know, North Dakota, it's always cold, and so they need help. They're doing winter camping. They definitely need winter camping supplies. My aunt was saying that they would love to get some yurts out there. So they can continue to hold cultural events and meetings.
Yeah, at the event at Portland State, at the Native Center, Donica, who was actually on KBOO on Friday, and spent 3 weeks out there. She and another man who had spent time there were saying that the tents just are blowing away. You know, if you just bring like a regular tent, it might risk blowing away in the wind. They said they saw tents just sort of rolling around in the camp. So they're definitely looking for more heavy duty things. So yeah, anybody who's got a connection to a yurt or teepees, they're looking for teepees, yurts, or, you know, heavy duty, probably heavy duty army tents, or, you know, like really good mountaineering tents, anything like that would be even just one or two or three extra would probably go a long way, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. It's definitely, they need winter camping. My friend Desiree, she's been doing media for the camp and for the tribe, and she said they got piles of donations of old summer clothes, and they're like, we don't really need that. Be sure that it's winter stuff, things that they can really use, and I know that you know, that definitely they could get they need donations of food and things like that as well.
Well, listen,
the
we get
tribe
it.
Has been paying for all the garbage cleanup and the porta potties, the
chemical toilets and water delivery for the camps. And on security, they're doing security as well.
And obviously, they're not they're not just rolling in wealth, so they could use whatever help they can get to keep this this thing going. We have to get out of here, Jacqueline, because we have a program coming up live here in the studio. So we're going to bid you farewell. Happy journeys. Make sure you call KBOO News if there's any breaking stories to give us news reports about what's going on there. And we look forward to talking to you in a month again.
Sure. All right. Thanks for talking.
All right. And that was Jacqueline Keeler. And this has been the Pollen Nation Report edition of Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Thanks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Crybaby, produced and performed by Stageworks, Inc. Crybaby will take place at the Clinton Street Theater Friday and Saturday, October 14th and 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, October 16th at 2 p.m. Crybaby Live is a rockabilly musical homage to the John Waters cult classic film set in the 1950s in Baltimore. Again, that's Crybaby, the play, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Taste of Chives Oboe Addy Legacy Project iBook launch and potluck on Friday, October 21st at noon at Oregon State University Valley Library in Corvallis. The interactive and multimedia iBook is a collaboration between the Oboe Addy Legacy Project and the OSU Oregon Multicultural Archives to showcase the history and current community outreach of the Oboe Addy Legacy Project.